Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge, and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule, it's just whenever I finish a book, I do the review, stick it up here on the podcast feed. Today, I am joined once again by my girlfriend, Juliana. Say hello, Juliana.
Hello.
And we are going to be doing one of the final Hugula award-winning books that we have yet to review. What was the last one that we did? Oh no, the last one was we were in our other reading series, our culture series read-through that we were doing. But we previously we discussed a book called Ender's Game, and we didn't just discuss the book, we discussed the movie adaptation, the audiobook adaptation, the German translation, and what was the other thing that we reviewed as well?
Was I can't there something remember. Else?
No, I think it was... No, it was... Oh, yeah, it was Ender's Game, Alive, Movie, and Ender's Shadow. So we were talking about the other book.
Yeah, Ender's Shadow.
The Bean story, the Bean side story of that one. So we thought, hey, let's check out... We'll, at one point, because it won a Hugula Award, it won the Hugo Award and Nebula Award in the same year. And I put it on scrolling. So this also won, yes, in 1986... it won the Nebula Award, and it also won the 1987 Hugo Award. And it was published in a slightly revised edition in 1991. I don't know which edition that I listened to, because I listened to an Audible audiobook version. What did you read? You read a German ebook version, did you?
No, I had to do some... adventurous steps on the way to
Oh yeah, that's actually what we were talking about last time,
because
wasn't it?
Because the book was published, as you said, in the 1980s and
yeah.
this way around, at that point they didn't do any ebooks of
course
that
not.
Part. They did do ebook. They just recently did the ebooks about the Ender Shadows series.
Yeah.
Only the two Ender's Shadow books. There,
yeah. So they did a German translation ebook version of the Shadow books.
Series. But they don't. They have not done so far the sequels of the Ender's Game series.
Yeah, the actual
the Ender series. How do you call it? So I searched online and I found a page where you can get PDFs where they scanned in the books and then had the PDF. Version and then they did some corrections of how you should do it and stuff, and it was from some Russians,
of course.
So
loads of stuff goes through the Russian
that
sites
was,
and stuff.
Quite.
So what's it called in German? Because we normally talk about this one as well.
Sprecher für die Toten. Just
Speaker for the Dead. Exactly.
Translation.
Yeah.
Scanned and corrected by Nobody's Dot Ghost Covered, edited by Astaroth.
Yes, so just people going under different names anyway. So we read this one, because we were thinking about what should we read next, and you're like, hey, how about Speaker for the Dead? And I was like, yes, because that was a part of the Hugula series that I'm reading to make sure I have read and reviewed for the podcast every Hugo and Nebula Award winning book. No, not every one that's won either award. Every book that's won both awards. So let's get into it. So this bit, it actually says here... Speaking for the Dead, it takes place around about in the year 5,270, some 3,000 years after the events in Ender's Game. However, because of relativistic space travel, Ender himself is only about 35 years old, which we'll get into later. So yeah, let's talk a bit about this the world that is set up here. So we have 100 worlds, isn't it? Let's say there's the 100 worlds.
Yeah, they're all together in like a
congress, the Starways Congress.
An association kind of thing.
And the different worlds there's some people over here, and they are, it says they are Brazilian, Portuguese, Catholic worlds, and what's the name that I can't remember the name of that other the colony or that other planet, and they said, okay, so we're going to set off on this. I just realized here I saved this page and it hasn't saved it all. No, it has. Okay, so Lusitania is the planet that they head towards, and it was, but there was another planet, and they said, hey, you have permission to go and colonize this planet over here. But when they get there, this Catholic Brazilian Catholic Portuguese
mission
guy, they arrive there, and there's some aliens there, and there's some thinking
like
aliens.
The place is already taken.
It's already taken.
And
by...
it feels very much setting up colonism again.
But they say, okay, we're not going to do it badly this time. Last time we had any connection with an alien species, talking about the Formics, the buggers with in Speaker for the Dead, we wiped out... Spoiler. We wiped out all of the aliens. There's no left. It was a xenocide. It was a. We completely wiped out all of the aliens. We're not going to do that again. We're going to go back. We're going to go back to the drawing board in our alien first contact, and we're going to do as much as we possibly can to not disrupt the piggies or the what's they called the pequeños, which is Portuguese. For piggies, so they called them piggies. So these piggies aliens, and they said, okay, we're not going to let them see any of our technology. We're only going to let them meet one or two humans at any one time, and the humans who are going to study them, the biologist or the xenobiologist, they're only going to be allowed to, you know, they're not going to be able to have even a paper or pen or any writing. They can just talk in their language and ask questions, and then when they get back to the little colony, this little village, oh, it's like a town, isn't it? So
it's like a ghetto.
Yeah, it's like a ghetto with gates around it. And there's some fun discussion in the book how the piggies see it, like the humans say, oh, we're trapped in this fenced off town, and we're trapped here, and we can't get out into the wider world, and we're trapped here. But the piggies look at it and go, oh, we're trapped outside here. We're trapped out of the fence, and inside that fence is the way off of the planet, and inside that fenced off area is all of the library, and inside that fence is all of the technology, but we're stuck out here, we can't get into it.
Yeah.
Which is quite a funny thing, because we live in Berlin, and that always made, when they had that discussion, it made me think of the Berlin Wall, because the people outside, like, the Berlin Wall was surrounding West Berlin, but then there was at the inside, what they would call what you would say is the inside wall. There was actually two walls, wasn't there? There was the inner wall, yeah, and the outer wall. But the inner wall was actually, from the East German point of view, outside of the outer wall. So the outer wall was shorter and inside, like geographically was inside the inner wall, but it was called the outer wall because it was outside of East Germany. It, yes, was where the fascists lived, on the outside of East Germany. So it's one of those weird, like, what's the inside and what's the outside? Because if the inside has got the connection to the rest of the universe or the rest of the galaxy or the rest of the Starways, you know, 100 worlds or something, you know, that's... Anyway, I thought that was quite a fun discussion that they had there, which is kind of relevant to Berlin.
Yeah, this book has so many levels of reference to... many, many other problems of the,
yes,
humans,
yeah,
that I think we should go back and discuss that further later on.
Okay.
With all the colonization and first contacts and,
yeah,
stuff. And,
but this is another first contact book, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, it is another first contact book. And it is also about, as you said, it's about the human interaction with themselves.
Yes, what the humans do among,
yeah,
themselves.
And also their view on the world. So,
yeah,
meaning they feel trapped within the city, within the ghetto.
Yeah.
Although they have the ability of flying away.
Out. But they don't really either, but we'll get,
yeah,
into that in a bit. But yeah, what I liked about this setup is that it's like, okay, after the gung-ho military kind of style of Ender's Game, this book is like, oh no, humans have learned their lessons, and now we're,
yeah,
not going to treat the alien as the other. And there's these different names for where is it? Maybe I should have looked this up here. But yes, so there's the other Wigan, Peter, who was the hegemon back on Earth. He came up with these different ways of referring to strangers. Can you remember that? There's like the four names of the strangers.
Yeah.
I can't remember exactly what they are now, but there's like, okay, there's the stranger who is the same species of yours and is a friend who lives next door. And then there's the...
they're the different...
Yeah, and then there's the person
development.
Who is, yeah, and then there's someone who is the same species as you, but foreign, they're from a different land. And then there's a stranger who is different species from as you and from a different planet, but you can still associate with them.
So
and then there's the...
I don't know how they're called in English, because,
yeah,
I just have the German version. So,
yeah,
some of them are called Rayman.
Yeah.
Ramen, Framing.
Yeah, these are the ones I can't
remember. So some of them mean Framlinger, means some of them are developed and self-conscious about what they do,
yeah,
and they have a certain society with them, yeah, within them. And they are not like just like have, in earlier times, people called some people barbars. No, barbars.
Barbarians.
Barbarians. And some were the higher people. And this is a similar thing. And they take, I think, Icelandic or Nordic words,
yeah,
for them. So,
yeah, I think it's like Danish or Icelandic or something,
yeah,
like that. Yeah,
it's like some Nordic words they came from,
yeah,
and they have these different names for these different steps in evolution of.
But it's not just about evolution; it's about like how alien are they, you know? And that was the whole point, was that.
No, but they also referred to these like on for animals and stuff.
Yes, exactly. But what I'm saying is that at the beginning of the book, they're talking about the buggers, and the buggers were the most alien. But then when Ender, and we talked about this at the end of Ender's Game, when he writes the Hive Queen and the Hegemon, he actually brings them together, and so the Hive Queen was no longer the most alien, most unknowable, because he kind of wrote that book and he made them into like, ah, okay, in fact they weren't the real enemy, it was a whole mistake, it was a low point in our history. And
yeah, I think
like that.
What this also is supposed to say is that depending on what point of view you have on alien species.
Yeah, on the species.
They change.
Yeah, they fall into different categories.
They fall into different categories. So if you see a dog and you say, ah, oh, it's a dog. So it's a Framling or something.
Yeah.
And then, but then let's say if you would be able to learn the dog's language and you see, ah, oh, it's more complex than I thought.
Yeah.
Then that because you know about it, you know that species more, then that in your point of view, that gets rated up in the steps.
Yeah. So what they've done here in this book, they've gone, we learned our lesson of this different ranges of where if we meet intelligent aliens, where will they fall on this scale? And then they meet these piggies.
You don't judge them so quickly.
And the piggies are like, okay, let's be really careful. Where are they going to go onto this one? So it really kicks off when this story, it follows the story at the beginning of Lusitania colony, and they're out there studying the piggies, and they're going, okay, what's happening here? And then there was some Navinia, who is, her parents died, there was a plague as well, and so her parents died in the plague, and then she goes and works with Pipo and Libo, who are the two
So Navinia is a xenobiologist,
xenobiologist,
and Pipo and Lido are xenologists.
Yes.
So
they study alien culture and society.
Anthropologists.
Xenoanthropologists.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And she is a biologist because she wants to find out about more of the about the plague, and because her parents at that point found some cure for it.
Yeah, it was like a pill, like an injection.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
It,
and the people are taking that pill all the time with them, and they have it in the water and stuff.
Yeah.
And so she wants to continue this research on it. And so Pipo is the older, xenologist.
And Libo is the son. It's Libo.
Libo.
Pipo and Libo.
Pipo and Libo, yeah.
Yeah.
So it's his son. And Libo and Navinia are approximately the same age.
Yeah.
This is important to know.
It's very important to know.
Because
I don't want to get too deep into that. I mean, we don't need to get too deep into that story because I don't want to just recount the whole story, but the whole situation.
I just want to get it back in my head.
Okay, I'm just saying, but for what we really need to get onto is that Pipo is killed. Like, he goes, I've worked something out. Navinia shows him some, you know, something about the Descalada, which is the plague, and what was it? He says, I worked something out. Wait here, I'm going to go and talk to the piggies about it. And he goes off and talks to the piggies about it, and they're like, he hasn't come back yet. And then 4 hours later, they go out to find him outside the front gates of the
the village.
The village, yeah, outside the front gates of the village, and he has been cut open, he's been sliced open, and
taking all the guts out.
All the guts have been taken out and spread open, and he was obviously mostly alive while he was being cut apart. Now, we knew that this had happened before because another piggy, they'd found a piggy in the same way, looking very much the same. So they know that's how they kill each other, and they're like, well, what did he do wrong? What did he say wrong?
Yeah.
How did he do this? And the piggies have totally, utterly slaughtered one of the humans.
Just one question. When you've read that, that he I mean, it was quite sudden.
Yeah.
It wasn't like all prepared and then that something happened and now we're going to tell you the story about what happened. No.
Yeah.
It's like really, it is in the middle of the story and then he goes out and he's killed.
Yes.
What was your thought about that?
Well, I knew it was going to happen because I've read this book before.
Oh, okay.
Maybe twice before.
Definitely
at least once before, but twice before, maybe. Okay,
do you remember what you felt? What was it?
No,
like?
I don't, because it was 15 years ago when I read
probably
this book
like
for the
a
first
really,
time.
Probably like a really young boy reading. Oh my God, why did you
No, I was just reading it going, oh, this is good. No, the weird thing is, and I think I told you this before, that I read Ender's Game years ago. I was like, that's great. And then I read the follow-up to this, which was called... the follow-up to this is called Xenocide. I'm just going to make sure I get... Yeah, and then it's followed by Children of the Mind. And I read Xenocide before Speaker for the Dead. Not because I planned to, it's just because I was like, oh, yeah, in the series of this, you know, Ender's Game series, and there it was, Xenocide. So I read Xenocide before reading this book. So I kind of knew a bit about the stuff already. So, you know, a bit about what was going on. And then when I was reading this book, I was like, oh, which book is this? You know, because then I couldn't remember. It was like, is this the book where in the end the thing goes into the tree and there was a forest and a tree and they put the thing in the tree? And it's like, no, it wasn't that book. But there was there's something else with the trees here as well, because, you know, there's the Pekinos worship their trees, you know, and think they can talk to the trees. And the anthropologists go, no, you can't talk to your trees. What are you talking about? We're talking to you. And there's all that kind of stuff. But when I was reading this book again, I was thinking, oh, is this the one where Jane is doing this? Or is this the one where Ender does this? Or is this the one where where Valentine comes back and does that kind of stuff, and you're like, oh no, that's the next, you know. So it was weird when I was reading this book. I kind of knew everything that was happening in this book, and
but
I think
didn't know if it wasn't that.
I couldn't remember if it was in this book or the next book, and you know, certain scenes and characters. I couldn't remember if it was in this book or that next.
Well,
book.
I'm not so sure if I can talk about it, but when I read this, and I read it about how the piggies presented people there, it felt very much like a. Not so much a worship, but
like a ritual,
like a ritual. It didn't feel at all like, oh, they just slaughtered him.
Yes,
they just killed him.
They did something
like
right. Yes,
because
I understand
that. In the beginning, like in some of the where they put together the content of the book, they write that they meet some aliens and then they don't know if they're bad murderers and stuff. I never had the feeling that it was any bad thing that they did.
What, the Pekinios weren't doing bad things?
What I saw immediately was that the humans just didn't understand why they did it.
Yes.
And so it wasn't really much of a...
But the humans in the book are going, why did you slaughter this person? What did he do wrong? And you were thinking, he didn't do anything wrong.
Yeah, exactly.
I know, that's a feeling I have as well. And I think that is one of the weaknesses of the book, that like Orson Scott Card, who wrote this, is kind of like... He's trying to, what I'm trying to say, he's making something out to be a bit more of a mystery than it should have actually been.
It's exactly.
Like, it's a mystery of why that ritual, but you never once thought that, oh, this person has been punished. You always thought it's a ritual involving death.
Yeah, but it's not a bad thing.
Yeah.
So that was always my impression. And that was why I was asking you, because if you read it as a young person, maybe that would have been a different a way of feeling for you, because you as a young person, you don't get into the depth behind
it. I don't think it's something to do with being young or not young. I just think it's the way it's written. I think it's pretty obvious that the person isn't, like, in this, it's sort of like, you know, it's happened so early on in the book, and you know that's what it's going to be about. It's Speaker for the Dead. It's like, why did this person die? But I can't remember ever thinking that they died because they did something wrong. I always thought it was some kind of ritual which leads to death, and the Pekinios didn't realize how much it's... Yeah,
how different the humans would...
Yeah. It's important to say about this, that you when you have to... When you're talking about the Pekinios, there's always this thing is that we don't want to tell anything about the Pekinios, and we can't ask direct questions. We can't ask, why are you doing this to them, or why are you doing this in this way? Why do you use that word? Because the idea being is that even the questions that you ask... Tell them something about themselves. So they're always working in this kind of hands tied behind the back with a blindfold and earplugs in, and you know, and then it's just sort of like just by one sense, you know.
I find that these restrictions that they gave themselves to not give them any way of evolving their society and evolving in their technology, it is so weird that I didn't even understand. if you want to discover, so if you want to do some research on something, you have to put something of yourself into it.
Yeah.
You can't just say, oh, I'm just
totally objective.
Yeah. I'm not just looking at it. I can't get to know anything if I'm just looking at it. I have to understand why it is doing that. And if it's a conscious alien species, you can talk to them. And they even learn the same language, so they can try to communicate on the same level. But you can't just say, oh, I'm not telling you anything about me, but I want you to know everything about you.
Yeah, that's the difficult part. And this is the thing that all the way through the book, it's just like, why don't you just ask them what they do? Why don't you just ask them? But the whole point is that the rules are so strict that they can't ask anything, and they can't do anything. And if so, those people would lose, you know, they would lose all contact and wouldn't be able to live there anymore. And they'd move all the people off the colony, which is, of course, that's threatened later on in the book. So that's the big setup. So someone dies, and then we hear about, oh, there's this thing called a speaker for the dead. And what is a speaker for the dead? It's this new kind of humanistic religion, but not really religion, kind of a movement where when someone dies, someone can speak their death. In other words, comes in and finds out all of the things that happen, like why they were like they were, and what led through their life, and what they were like when they died, and why they died, and what you should think about them, or what, you know, not what you should feel about them, but here are the facts of their life, so you can have an objective view of their life rather than your subjective view of their life. Yes.
And this is what I found really funny, that they call them speaker for the dead.
Yeah.
Is when they actually speak for their life. They speak about their lives.
The life of the dead person. Yeah.
To explain the person and to explain their lives and why, how it could have come that they died and stuff. So it's a funny thing that I think the name is not very, I don't know, it's not just...
I think it's an interesting name.
Name is interesting, but then at the end, well, for the first place, I didn't really know what I should think about what a speaker for the dead could be, but...
I think it's explained pretty well once Ender turns up and starts doing his job when he does
his job. I totally understand what he's doing there, and I really like the idea of it.
Yeah,
I really do, because so many people don't get misunderstood.
Yeah,
and they have so much more to them.
Was there an afterwards in your book? Because in the audiobook there was an afterwards by Orson Scott Card himself. He comes on and talks for 10 minutes about the book, and I thought it was fascinating. I'm not going to wait. We can't wait and make all the audio, the podcast
you
listeners.
You just asked me a question.
Wait until.
And I can't. No, I don't think there's
not afterwards. One. Okay. No. So anyway, so this was just. I don't think it was, because it sounded like it's something he'd recorded just for the audiobook.
Yeah.
And he was saying, oh yes, I was, you know, he's a Mormon. So he was like, I was down on a mission in Portuguese Brazil. Yeah. Brazil, anyway. Yeah. So that's why that's why he knows all of this language and knows the Catholic and the way. And he said, I went along to a funeral of a guy who had a wife, and his wife was totally unhappy, like, because it was a really, like, it was an abusive relationship. He was drunk all the time, and it was terrible, and they were separated, but they couldn't be officially divorced, because they're Catholic, so they couldn't be divorced. And so, but he had a new mistress that he had kind of married again, but she wasn't, because she wasn't allowed to, you know. And they went along to the funeral. And the woman was like, you know, they said there's like the ritual is like every few minutes she'll get up and say something about the husband. And it was, oh, he was such a kind man. And it's something so sad he died, and so sad like that. And then she'd sit down again. And then a few minutes later, would get up and start wearing, oh, I can't believe he's died. He was such a great husband. He was a fantastic. And he said she was taking revenge on her husband, because he wasn't like that at all. And she was actually destroying his real life. She was destroying what everyone actually knew about him. Everyone knew it was lies. She was creating a new memory, and like a new story, and that was actually her. And he said, you know, that was actually what it was like when he was watching it, that she was destroying his real life. She was taking away his real personality. And so he thought, oh, wouldn't it be interesting if there was a ritual where, instead of like getting up, and he says all funerals are really bad, are really boring, and they're totally dishonest, because everyone says, oh, it's either like it's a Christian one, it's either like a Christian style where it's like, oh, okay, well, this person gets up and tells lies, or they avoid the life all together and just say, oh, and we're going to see him again in heaven, and it just becomes a Christian service. You know, there's a different way. Of course, he's talking about it from the Christian, well, I guess he's a Mormon, so he's talking about it from the, you know, like the more Western Abrahamic religion, kind of, but yeah, more Protestant. I don't know. Whatever the rituals are, it's very dishonest. And he said, wouldn't it be interesting if we had something that was totally honest? And yeah. That's what he wanted to write about in Speaker for the Dead. And he actually says it's quite interesting that Ender's Game became the bigger book and the more successful book, because this was the book that he really wanted to write about. He was like, what would it be like to talk about at Hitler's funeral? What would it be like for someone to actually get up and tell the real story? Not so you like him in the end, but you understand him in the end.
Yes.
And that's what Ender's Game is. It's like, how do you understand someone who commits genocide? How do you understand someone who commits xenocide? How do you understand someone who becomes that, you know, awful person and does really evil things? You know, how do you understand
that's
them?
The thing with humans, they mostly think in black and white.
Yeah.
But there's never black and white.
Yeah.
And even in the most evil, evil, evil people,
yeah,
there is something there that they had. They were once a kid as well.
Yeah.
And they were once a young adult, which was led in the wrong way because of certain emotional stress or something.
Yeah.
And this is what I really like about this, speaking the truth, is that it's not black and white, because there is no black and white in the truth.
Yeah.
The truth is all kinds of reflections. It shows everything.
And we do get that. So what happens is that, let me just say, we'll move on with the story, but we'll circle back around to this, but that Navinia calls, once Pipo is killed by the piggies, she says, hey, I want a speaker for the dead. And so the call goes out for, where's the closest speaker for the dead? Because there isn't any on that little colony, because it's so small and it's a Catholic world and they don't have one. So Navinia calls in what?
No, didn't she? No, Libo called
no,
him first.
No, Navinia called for the speaker of the dead for Pipo. It's very, very explicit right there at the beginning. She says, I am going to call for a speaker for the dead. 4 days later, she says, oh no, I don't want a speaker for the dead anymore.
Okay.
But it turns out that Ender has already got the call and he's already on his way.
Right.
He buys himself a spaceship because he's got lots of money. Buys himself a spaceship and zips over there.
But
it takes him. It's going to take him 22 years. It's going to take him 20 days or a week or something. But it's going to be 22 years
on the planet.
On the planet as it goes by.
Right.
And in that time, Navinia grows up to be like older, and she's super bitter, and she's got kids of her own, and they're growing
super
up.
Many.
Yeah, like six kids, like four sons and two daughters. And you thought, oh, well, she's going to get together with Libo, but she doesn't get to. I don't think we need to go into all the details why she doesn't get together with Libo, but there's certain, you know, data access things that she can't get married. But Libo grows up and gets married to somebody else and has other kids of her own, and then the next story comes in, and we've, like, by the time that Ender arrives, we've got, like, these two new generations. Like, the young people have grown up, and now they're in charge of the xenobiology and xenology.
Yeah.
And then the younger generation of kids who have grown up, and they're all under 20, because it's taken them 20 years to get there. They're all, like, you know, 18 years old and 19 and 15 years old, and some kid is, like, 12 years old, the one with no eye. Oh, he's only got... Yeah, he doesn't have any eyes anymore.
Yeah,
and he's got computers in his eyes. Which is good fun. So all these young kids, and then Ender meets up with them, and it follows their story as well. Meanwhile, Libo, also killed by piggies, somebody has called his death, and then someone else, a few, like a year before or something, Navinia's husband has died, her abusive husband has died, and somebody calls the Speaker for the Dead to speak for them as well. So when the Speaker for the Dead turns up, Andrew Wiggin turns up. He's like, right, let's start speaking for the dead. And Navinia's like, no, but I cancelled my call. He's like, haha, but there's been some other calls have gone out and nobody knows who gave the calls out. So Ender gets there, and so he's got three deaths to speak. Pipo, the original guy who was killed by the piggies. Libo, his son, also killed by the piggies. And then Navinia's husband and the father of all the children, the abusive father of all the children. I can't actually remember his name, but his
I
name
have it
is
here.
No, his name is. I've got
I
the list here as well.
Markow,
and he's also called the dog, too. So yeah,
I think this is pronounced something like Markow.
Macau. I'm just saying, in the audiobook, Macau.
Okay.
So yeah, there's that stuff going on. So he turns up there, and this is what I'm saying, bringing back to the Speaker of the Dead, one of the things he does is, like, this abusive husband. He's like, why was this abusive husband like that? But then why did she stay with him, and why did she stay with her?
Yeah.
And yeah, it's there's lots of stuff going on there, which is very tricky to work out. And then there's all the kids and what they do together, and the, you know, their
and
relationships.
How they treat the speaker for the dead.
Yeah.
When he comes in and speaks the truth.
Because he's only like
35.
Nobody
wants to hear the truth.
Of course nobody wants to hear the truth. Except some of the kids do. There was one kid who is really violent and stuff, but his father was never looking after him.
Gregor.
Yeah, Gregor, was it? It was the younger. Yeah, it was the younger one. And Gregor comes in and they're like, and you know, how is he going to be dealt with? And it turns out speaking for the dead isn't just good at speaking for dead people, also pretty good at working out why alive people are damaged as well. And he's got this, you know, this almost supernatural way of looking at people and going, aha, I know what I need to do here. Aha, I know what I need to do here. You know, that kind of thing. Oh, yeah.
No. The thing is, he doesn't know what to do, but it's just his he behaves somehow, and he thinks, that might be handy. That might be how the treatment that the person needs right now. Very often he says, oh, I don't know what I do. Yeah. I have no idea. I have no plan. I don't know what I'm doing.
Yeah.
I'm just doing it. It's just some impulse he has. It's just very, very human, very humanist.
Yeah, I guess so.
He's just a very good human towards understanding, very empathetic.
Yeah, empathetic.
Yeah, but that's what he does.
But that's why he was such a good fighter, or such a good soldier in the first
because
book.
He was empathetic to his enemy.
Yes, he understood. Like, that's the whole point, is that once you understand your enemy completely, you love them and then you destroy them. Like, you know, you can't help but love them, but then you have to destroy them anyway, or then you do destroy them, and then you can destroy them. And in this book, it's from the other side. It's like, yes, I understand my enemy, or I understand the problem completely, and then I can't help but love them. But then, instead of doing the destroying them, then he fixes them. You know,
yes.
Like, that's the thing. With the pig is, he understands them. Of course, that's what happens near the end. He starts understanding them, he knows all about them, and then he doesn't destroy them. You know, he can fix something there.
And also, this is very much a book about guilt as well.
Yeah.
And how everyone in the universe, except Ender, thinks that Ender is, how they're calling him? Ender the monster.
Yeah, he's the monster, yeah.
So everyone else in the world thinks that Ender was the Xenocide monster.
Yeah.
Which is then also, again, why is he the monster? If all the adults trained him and did all that for him to succeed.
He was the scapegoat.
He didn't do it by, like, just so. He didn't know what he was doing at that point.
Yeah.
And so it's very fun. It's very interesting that they are all calling him the monster, and at the same time he's with under them. Because he's 3,000 years old.
Yeah.
And,
but he isn't really 3,000 years old. He's just lived through 3,000 years of history.
Of history of all planets.
But he still is only 35 years old.
But, what did I try to say? It's this whole guilt thing. And Ender has this guilt to carry around, that everyone thinks he's the... he killed lots of...
Yeah, but then Lavinia thinks the same thing as well about Pipo, because she's I did this thing that led to his death. Yeah.
And this is my guilt.
And she brings that guilt on board her and she forces herself to live with it. It's like a self-punishment.
It's a self-punishment. But the thing is, because of the self-punishment, she's not punishing only herself. She's punishing everybody around her.
Well, that's what Ender is doing himself when he's doing all this traveling. He's punishing himself. He's like, I can't stay in a new place. I have to, remove myself. Like, he's removing himself. He's not letting himself have a life until he reaches this place. And he's like, now I can have a life.
But even when he leaves this planet where he was stationary before with his sister.
Valentine. That's a punishment.
He's leaving her.
Yeah.
That is the biggest punishment he had so far.
Yeah.
So it's always about guilt and then punish yourself. And what comes out after that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's the guilt thing.
Yes,
so it is. I can very much feel this whole situation very much, because I'm a German, and whenever I go somewhere, anywhere in the world,
a German,
and whenever I go as a German somewhere, people always have Hitler and the World Wars and all this stuff in their head.
Yeah,
and it's not my guilt. I didn't do anything,
but
because society puts this guilt on on
yes.
every German. It's this weird, how do I behave to that? I can say, yeah. okay, yeah, I'm...
That wasn't me, it wasn't my father, it wasn't my grandfather.
My whole family wasn't even part of it. And I know that because I did research. But
yeah, exactly. But why did you do that research?
But like, why did I do that? To defend myself.
Yeah, to make yourself feel better about yourself?
Yeah, I don't know. This is a weird thing about this. I don't have to defend myself.
Yeah.
But still, because I was born there, it wasn't even something I chose.
No, of course not.
I chose. I just happened
to be there.
And that's
the thing, Ender didn't choose to do what Ender did.
He was just a puppet. And
but Bean did choose. Bean knew.
Yeah, Bean knew. Yeah.
Okay, there's something else.
Oh, well.
There's another book to talk about. Yeah. So, yeah, so that's what I really like about this. So let's move on, because we talked quite a while about this kind of stuff. Yeah, so Ender coming in and sorting stuff out. This is another thing that I quite liked about the book, which is like... And this is the thing that I think is so impressive with a lot of science fiction. Like, a lot of... Oh, not just science fiction, a lot of fiction. You can have go, oh, there's space battles, like in the previous one. There's games and space battles, and there's alien invasions and all this kind of stuff. And you're like, that is where tension is. That is where drama is. But some of my favourite science fiction and other fiction is, like, the drama is within a room with three people in it. You know, and two people know what's going on, and one person doesn't know what's going on, but the person who doesn't know what's going on is saying something and going, oh, what's going on? You know, like, just that very simple, like, just a conversation, just an argument, just a discussion, just, like, asking questions can have, it seems to have, like, more import and more drama going on yeah. just with a small conversation. That's what this book is about. It's about, you know, I looked here on the Wikipedia page, and it says, lack of film adaptation. Orson Scott Card does not want this to be made into a film. For example, he says, it consists of talking heads interrupted by moments of excruciating and unwatchable violence. And you're like, yes, okay, that's it. Long conversations, talking heads, plus violence. And it's that excruciating violence, and it's that kind of spectre of xenocide in the past, and the spectre of, like, will this lead to the piggies being wiped out in the future, or will it lead to humans being wiped out in the future? You know, that whole kind of thing. But it's not played out with space battles. It's played out with conversations between people.
Yes.
And, yes, it's, I thought it was very interesting.
Yes, some of that was a bit too much for me.
You didn't like the long conversations?
Yes, no, I don't know the long conversation, but some that Ender thought and said, I think, was a bit too preacher-like. Yes. It felt a bit...
He is a Superman, and that's the thing. It's like, yeah. His superpower is... I know it's weird to say his superpower is empathy, but it does get a bit too much. Like, sometimes in that first... in the first book, Ender's Game, I felt it was, you know... I know that's the flaw. It's like, of course, that's what this book is about. That's what this series is about, is his power of empathy. But it seems to be always a bit too convenient that he does something and grabs something and says something. It just happens to be the right thing. And it says here, when he's doing that speaker for Macau, it's the speaker for the dog, the dead, you know, but his nickname was the dog. When he said that, it was like, oh, and he said this. And I really enjoyed that scene, because it's sort of like, oh, and these people watching on thought, oh, yes, he's saying the right thing. I wonder who he talked to about that. And he didn't talk to anyone. He just guessed at it. And I'm like, well, how can you just, and that's so important, and the truth is so important, but you just, he just, like, instinctively knew what was going on with that when in his childhood.
Yeah, he's so good in putting himself in that position that he knows what.
And I felt that a bit too. I would have liked it if he had actually spoken to them. They said, oh, nobody would remit to that they were the person to tell Ender this, because they weren't allowed, you know, because they were Catholics and he was, you know, the humanist coming in, and they were told not to cooperate, and they didn't, but he got the full story anyway. And I was just like, well, why would they, you know, of course that some of it was explained and some of it he could have picked up, but it's like some of it seemed, it always seems a little bit too magic or a little bit too convenient that he does get stuff spot on the first time, you know, there's not.
And he doesn't even, he himself says even that he doesn't know why and how.
Yeah.
It just comes to him.
Yeah.
And also what I didn't quite, did you, I don't, maybe I just forgot it. Did he speak actually the three dead?
No, he only spoke the one death. But in speaking that one death, it kept everything.
Libo,
yeah, he included Libo.
Yeah, Pippo, not so much.
No, not Pippo, because Pippo, he wasn't, because then that speaking was cancelled, you know, because that was that was Navinia's first thing. But it was all explained, you know, in the end, it was all explained through the book.
True.
But thankfully, it was just one scene that came to the speaking. I did feel it a bit convenient that it was the speaking that happened, and the things with the Pequeno had happened, and all these other things. It all happens, like, in one afternoon.
Yes.
And that does seem, again, a little bit convenient. But at least there was the tension there. but for the rest of the book, like, that one afternoon took longer than 22 years than other parts of the book, so
yes,
it felt a little
some
bit
some parts
uneven.
Of the book were a bit heavy to put your way through to reading all the things there.
And again, a lot of speaking heads, a lot of
conversations. Yeah, a lot of conversation stuff.
Yeah.
What I would like to talk about is also colonization stuff.
Yeah.
Because while reading that book, I watched, for the first time, guess what? I watched Avatar.
Oh, yeah, we're going to talk about this, aren't we? Yeah, I remember you saying.
And
I was like, oh, it's about the trees, about, you know, the tree, the thinking trees and the animals, and in the end, they transfer the consciousness into the other body.
Yes, of course it's about that. But for me, that book was that movie was so much more like a Pocahontas colonization, human colonize.
Dances with Smurfs.
Yeah,
Dances with Wolves.
I haven't seen.
You
that
haven't
one.
Seen Dances. No. It's more like Dances with Wolves than any other movie.
But it's just like,
but with Smurfs.
Humans come somewhere. It could have been on Earth. Could have been
the place is called Pandora. Pandora? Yeah, it's called Pandora, isn't it? The planet of Pandora.
Yeah.
And it's just like, oh. And then they're trying to get unobtainium, and they're like, oh.
it's
heavy-handed.
But this is so much like, obviously, a human behavior to go somewhere and say, this is mine. I'm just going to take it. And
but they don't in this book.
Yeah, let me just...
Yeah.
In Pandora... not Pandora Star. No, Avatar.
Yeah.
It's this whole thing where, oh, and he's on the human side, and he's trying to do this and that and that. And then, in the end, he's on the other side and stuff. I really like the movie. No offense there. But it is very much... It puts you back in rethinking how humans work. And humans are very much like, oh, we go somewhere. Oh, it's nice. We take over that, and there are people living on it. It might not be people. They might just be animals, and they
we'll
just
call them
look
aboriginals.
Like, yeah, we just treat them like animals. They look like them. They don't speak our language. They are animals. And with the Speaker of the Dead, it is similar. They go somewhere. They take over a certain space in the planet. Obviously, they're not made for the planet, but it doesn't matter. We just stay there, and we try to get to know the natives without them giving them the same right to get to know us too. So it's this weird.
So you say even in this book where they're trying to do everything right,
yes,
they still can't. They still don't treat other things as equal.
Exactly. This
but
is the thing.
Are they equal though?
Well, you don't know if they are equal
if you
don't get to know them, and they don't get to know you.
Yeah, I know, and that's one of these such a weird things when I was when you're reading this book in so many ways where it says we're like 3,000 years further into the future.
Yeah,
but it doesn't feel that way to me. It feels like we're 20 years into the future. You know, it feels old already. And of course,
it's from the 1980s.
Yes, I know it's from the 1980s. But in this book, it's like, oh, yeah, these people are speaking Brazilian Portuguese and they're Catholics. And I'm like, you know, how old is Brazil? As a country, how old is Brazil? Like 150 years? I don't even know, actually. I go to Brazil a few times a year these days, but I don't know the full history of it. But Brazil isn't that old. And it's only been around, and then they say in 3,000 years' time, Brazilian Portuguese is still going to be a distinct thing, and Catholic is still going to be a distinct thing, as opposed to, I think it mentions Mormons or something in this, but no, it's sort of, Ender's, it actually says that Ender's parents, one of them was a Catholic, and one of them was a Mormon or something, and it was a thing in their past, and I'm thinking, oh, is that what Orson Scott Card is? Was he half Mormon, half...
He's a third.
Yeah, is he also a third child? But in that kind of thing, and that's one of those things that I liked so much that they're like, oh, humanity has moved on, that they're going to have a first contact and it's not going to be Xenocide and they are going to hold back so much. But I'm thinking that with a pre-technological society, you could send in, like these days, we could send in a drone which looked exactly like a bird. Or maybe not now, but maybe in 10 years' time, we'll be able to send in these tiny little drones that are like millimeters across, which will be able to video everything that's going on and send that stuff back. You know, that's what science fiction would be talking about now. Of course, 30 years ago when this book was written, it was all about, we have an Ansible, and it's very, very low technology. It's like, oh, someone has a replacement eye, and they can record stuff, and they can show, oh, there was an argument at home, and they showed it. It's like, yeah, now everyone has mobile phones, everyone has video recording and photos all the time, you know.
Yeah.
Like, the idea that these people could go in there and not have, like, even these humans who go in and they say, oh, we can't even have a dictaphone, because a dictaphone, they'll be like, what's that recording device that you have there? Like, you don't even just put the phone in your pocket, or, like, you know, like, there's just nothing, like, have, you know, you have these little spy cameras, like, why wasn't that a thing? Like, yeah. Why wasn't just having, like, like, going somewhere in the Google, like,
some
Glass?
Stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, were they allowed to have glasses? And it's,
but
it's
then I think, do you have the right to go somewhere where somebody doesn't know about your technology and then just hide it from them?
Yeah, exactly. And do you have the right to keep them away from the stars? And that's what the piggies were like, no, we want to go to the stars. You come from the stars. We want to go to the stars. We don't want to go down to the stars. And then there'd be no stars left because the humans have taken over them all.
It turns out that the humans got their super high drive, whatever, quick flying hyperspace drive from the buggers.
And not also that, but they also got all of the worlds. Oh, like, that was the main rush of expansion.
Exactly. So
in the start was that they just took over the world.
If humans can do profit? No.
Yeah, they benefit from...
From the other alien species. And then they don't let other alien species profit.
That's what this book is about.
This is just not right. And I don't know. Maybe it is right. The thing with that is...
Okay,
like,
but let's look at it. Let's see if it would work in the same way for humans. Okay, so what happens if Christopher Columbus went across to the New World, and instead of just going, I'll enslave all these people, I'll make these people work for gold, and then this will be a new place for expansion. What if he went over there and was like, what we can do is we can kind of, like, I don't want to say uplift, but we can bring up all the people here, and we can teach them about steel, and we can teach them about this, and we can teach them about that, and then we'll have a new thing to sell our culture. We'll be able to bring over things and sell them to all of these Americans. No, of course, because they wouldn't do that, because they'll be like, no, there's no way that we're going to give... we're going to give weapons to any of these people. We're not going to teach them about how to make weapons. We're going to keep that to ourselves as white people. We're going to keep this,
and
you know.
That's always the basic thing it comes to. It's about education. Educate people, and they won't... They might decide to kill you.
Yeah.
And they might decide something different than you want. As soon as you educate them, you give them they're self-conscious.
Yeah.
Why if Columbus, like, when he went over there, why was it that his society, his cultural background was that he had to teach them? Why didn't they just say, okay,
because he had weapons,
we teach each other, and we get to know each other, and then we see how much do we want to know each other. Maybe it would have been easier the native people there could have said, oh no, we're actually not interested in you.
Well, of course, that's what probably we were saying. None of these people are like, oh yes, come in, teach us all about it. No, it was people with guns people with guns who wanted gold and land and new spices and stuff turn up somewhere and say, you tell us what we can take from you.
Yeah.
That's always what it is. You know,
but
there's never, it's never too...
With native people, most of them are actually quite... open.
But this is what all science fiction is about. You know, when all of these first contact things is like,
how can we do it better than we did it every time before?
And this is the thing that science fiction wrestles with. It's like, okay, what happens if we turn up and aliens are slightly more technologically advanced than us? It doesn't matter, because they won't just be slightly more technologically advanced. They'll be way, 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 way more advanced if they turn up here.
Yeah.
But if we get there, we're going to be way, 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 way more technologically advanced than they are. Whoever arrives first, whoever arrives at the place is going to be more technologically advanced.
Yeah.
Because if it wasn't that way, the people from North America and the Caribbean, or wherever Christopher Columbus went across to for the first time, they would have come back across to Europe and said, hey guys, what's happening over here?
Yeah.
You know, but that it didn't happen that way around, you know.
Yeah, true.
So that's what science fiction first contact is generally all about. And that's what the more interesting first contact science fiction happens when you don't go and visit the home world. It's like two spaceships meet in space, and they're both looking at each other. Yeah, and one's going, oh, what's going on over here? And the other one's going, oh, what's going on? We're both in space. We're both between the stars. We're both here. You know, that's the level. Like, that's actually kind of the more interesting first contact science fiction in the space, you know, like a Rendezvous with Rama. Like, they swing through, and just the fact that the guys could get to Rama was enough to show that they could understand what's going on there, or maybe it was possible for them to understand what's going on.
But the weird thing is that humans have this very distinct idea of
alienness.
Enemies and friends. And if they categorize something an enemy, then they are
it's open season
killing it.
Yeah.
So, and the question about that is always: if there would be an alien species coming, would they have the same opinion about
death? No.
And this is exactly what's in here. And this is exactly what makes it so different from the humans, like the buggers and the pekinios had a different view on death.
Yeah.
And humans just did not understand this.
No.
They had no idea that any other species could think differently about
death. And that's what we have both of this. You know, the buggers thought one way about death, and the pekinios think another way about death.
And the humans, a totally different way.
Humans think a third way about death. You know, there's three different species, and they all think differently about death. Now, we've been talking 49 minutes about this. We have not talked about any of the names of the buggers, any of the biology... No, not the buggers.
Of the pekinios.
We haven't talked about the Hive Queen. We haven't talked about Jane. Do you want to talk about Jane or the Hive Queen? Because I know the thing is, some of those issues are the most interesting things, but we've talked about this.
Yeah, but I don't think this is like, this is something that when you read the book, this is something.
So you can discover and discover. Yeah, so we won't talk about that.
Yeah, because the other things is something that goes more deep into it that other people might get different things out of it.
Yeah.
But this is like the
Talking about but the thing is, we've talked for 50 minutes already. I could talk for another 2 hours about this book because there's a lot more going on here.
And this
I don't think we need to go into it too much
this
more.
This is why I read some of the people who reviewed and
on Goodreads
and gave stars and rated it, and
go through some of these.
It's so different. It's so different. Some gave 4 or 5 stars, and the other
one of my all-time favorites.
Yeah, and some other give just 1 star. It's like either you give them 5 or 4,
there's no two stars.
Yeah, but there's no three stars. There's no 3 stars.
Yeah,
it's either 1 or 2.
Oh, that's really true.
Yeah, there's one here, but it like of the most of them, it's just either you like it very much or you just think. Compared to Ender's Game, it's just nothing.
Yeah.
And I think either of them, it's the same thing as we just talked about the whole hour there. Either way, that depending on from which point of view you're looking at this book, your opinion of saying, oh, this is not cool, I don't really like that. There's too much talking. It's too much preaching. It's too much... Blah, blah, blah.
Oh, I think it's too much talking and preaching, but I still think it's an amazing book.
Exactly. So, but most of the people either see... Oh, it's a great book by itself. It's a great book of that.
Despite,
maybe these people didn't like Ender's Game so much.
Yeah, but why would you read this book? Again, I say, why would you read this book without reading Ender's Game? But I kind of, I did read them out of order. I think, you know, like I did read Xenocide. Just say we're on a cruise ship at the moment and they're just starting the engines below us. And,
okay,
you know, so.
Well, we should wrap that up.
Okay, no,
so,
there's
anyway,
some more stuff
I gave about. I gave it 4 stars because I think I really, I don't see so much the connection to Ender's Game beforehand. It is totally different.
Oh, so it's an opposite book.
It's an opposite book. It has lots of preaching in it. It has lots of talking in it. And it has lots of, and there's this storyboard here. And then we cut this off and go to somewhere else. And then we have this long bit of the story here. And this is sometimes what's a bit annoying. But I really, really enjoyed all the themes and all the topics that it had in it.
Well, I did too. And that's why I'm giving it 4 stars as well. I did, again, there are some slow parts. There are some pretty parts. Ender is still as unbearable in this book as in the other book. And there is stuff
just
going
perfect.
On. But there were some really, really... like really interesting passages, and that's how I know a book really affected me, where like the book started and I was like, except for the point that I couldn't remember some of the scenes, the scenes were in this book or if they were from the other book, but I was just reading, and when Jane is introduced for the first time I was like, oh, Jane, and then I remembered so many lines of hers and like her whole story and all that whole thing when Ender takes the earpiece out for the first time, and it was just heartbreaking, but the thing is I knew that was coming, and I was just like, no, he does, and there's that. You see it from her point of view and like how time works differently for Jane.
Yeah, I really enjoyed Jane.
And then it's sort of like, and he's got the Hive Queen, and you're like, oh, and that whole part, you know, and you remember that whole story. And And you there's all these different things. And when this character turns up, like it wasn't in my head, but as soon as it mentions the kid with the eye, you know, with being able to record, I'm just like, oh yeah, he was the kid, and that's going to be a big thing later, that he's going to be recording that, and at a certain time he's going to play back some abuse between his father and his mother, you know, that stuff. And it was there again, and like the whole, all of the relationships that played out, and it was all just so clear in my head. Like I say, I probably read this book twice before, but not for 10 years or so like that. But it just, a lot of it came back, and that is a sign of good writing, when I can read a book a second time and it all just be still there in my brain.
And you still enjoy it.
And I still enjoyed it. Yeah, and it was really good. But like I say, it's not a perfect book. I think it is a bit too overblown, and I think the plotting is a little bit convenient sometimes.
Yes.
It didn't feel organic enough. And in the end, it's sort of like, oh, and then Ender just happened to be exactly the right age to get together with Navin. And you're like, oh, really? That's what's going to happen? That he looks at her first as a 15-year-old girl?
But that was so obvious before.
Yeah, but I don't want it to be that obvious. But I do like Valentine is coming back. You know, yes. Like at the end, I think that's
so
it.
So we know that there will...
The team is going to get together.
There is another book. We know that before,
of course,
but
like I say, I read that beforehand, so
yeah.
And that was a bit weird at the beginning of this book, where it's like, oh, and Ender's leaving behind Valentine. I was like oh no. But I was thinking, wait a second, no, I remember, she was in this book, she's in this book. And then I was like, again, it's one of those things, oh no, that's in the next book. They get back together again. So yes, 4 stars for this book. You can I listened to it as an audiobook. It was a very good audiobook. Let me quickly check on my Audible app and I will see who read it. It was although no, it's, I bet it's not going to say,
you
is it?
You will quickly do that.
I will
it
quickly.
Takes, quite
I will,
a while
no, it's here.
To
here we
bring
go.
It up.
Speaker. Oh yes, this is why I wanted to talk about this. Okay, check this out. Speaker for the Dead. How can I look for the information? The view details. The Audible app has changed, so you can't just go. So it goes here. Orson Scott Card, narrated by David Burney, Stefan Rudnicki, but it isn't just by them. It's actually narrated by, like, 7 or 9 different audiobook narrators.
Oh, really?
And so when it first started off, I was like, oh, this is, you know, there's one person here as well. What does it say here? Not Doomsday Book. David Burney. Oh, no, it doesn't. It only has those two names. But, yeah, it's sort of like there's 4 male narrators and 3 female narrators. Maybe more. I can't remember.
Read different characters or just
no,
parts
that's
of the
No, that's the
book?
Thing. It doesn't work that way. It started off with one person, then it switched to another. And then I was like, oh, so there's a male narrator and a female narrator, because I didn't look it up. And then it was like, oh, no, there's definitely 2 male narrators. And then I was like, oh, no, actually 3 male. And then it's like, no, there's definitely at least 2 female, because one of the female narrators wasn't very good at all. I mean, it wasn't bad, but like whenever she would do Navinia, it was like, oh, I need to do this. Oh, no.
What?
Yeah, it's
no,
all like
this. Voice
oh,
is not how I thought.
Oh, and it was always like this. I mean, I'm not. It wasn't exactly like that, but it was one of those things where I'm just like, oh no, just read it straight. Not everything has to be. Not everything has. Wow, this ship is making a lot of noise now. Not everything has to be like this. And then it would switch back to another. But at some points it worked. I'm like, why don't they just have one narrator? Because so often, things aren't just narrated from one point of view in the book. It actually switches around a lot, and that's very clear within the part where he actually does the speaking for the dead for Markau, where Ender speaks for Markau. And it's like, and he talks it, and it goes to this weird, like, more of a third person, like, more distant. It's sort of like, and then he would say this, and then these people over here were thinking this, and these people, and it was a lot more omniscient. It was like, you're going into this person, this.
Yeah.
But that was actually really interesting, because then it would cut between the lots of different
people,
voices.
Yeah.
And that was like, this is actually, and it's like whoever, I think it was actually Stefan Rudnicki who produced it. He's, you know, does lots of audiobooks, lots of science fiction audiobooks. And I was thinking, well, maybe he had that idea for that scene, and it actually works really well for that scene. However, the rest of the time, it was kind of annoying, because some of them were really good, and some of them were like, oh, this is how I think Ender should talk, and now this is how I think some of the kids should talk, and now this is how I think, you know, Navinia should talk. And then it would switch across, and then it was the wrong voice doing that. It was the wrong narrator doing that voice or doing that thing. And I was like, this isn't who I want to be doing this part of the book. So, yeah, in some ways it was interesting. Otherwise, it was a little bit annoying. However, this is the version that's there on Audible. If you want to listen to this audiobook for free, get a free trial from Audible. Go to audibletrial.com/SFBRP. You can get this book for free and then continue on with a book a month. What do you have? You have a book a month, don't you, on your gold plan? I have a platinum plan on Audible. I get 2 books a month. It costs me about 20.
I get one per month. But I have such a big backlog. So
oh, really?
I probably have like 8...
Yeah, I don't.
Credits or something.
Yeah, I have two credits.
Yeah,
because
I'm still reading Judas and Chain, listening to Judas and Chain, and it just takes me ages.
Yeah, you're doing Peter F. Hamilton.
It's good.
It's just very long. We'll do an episode on that. When you finish it, I'll read through the Wikipedia pages of Pandora's Star and Judas and Chain, and we'll do an episode. I'm not reading it all again, but I'll read the Wikipedia page and listen back to my reviews.
Next up.
Oh, no, I never read it.
Next up,
audibletrial.com/SFBRP. See you there. Yes, next up, we will do what?
I don't know. With the Inner Banks?
Yeah, we could do that. Peter Watts just released a book, first book he's released in like 5 or 6 years since Blindsight, and I really enjoyed that, and I've just finished it last night, Echopraxia. So I will be reviewing that in the next few days, I'm sure, Echopraxia. And, we can move on. We can do Ian M. Banks' last culture book, but not the last one. We've got two more culture books to get through.
Yes.
So we can finish them off. And and also it's coming up to episode 250, and someone emailed me and said, messaged me on Goodreads, hey, are you going to do something special for episode 250? And I was like, maybe. So if you've got any suggestions, email me, luke@juggler.net. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm Luke Burge. You can become my friend on goodreads.com. I think that's all we have to say.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks a lot, and I'll catch you next time.
Goodbye.